sense of anguish and panic. It's in your head. At the same time, mountain climbers who don't adapt well to extreme elevation, and this seems to be largely genetic, unrelated to fitness or experience, often get sick and sometimes die at the elevations scaled by Messner. That's not in their heads. But in practice, assigning the blame to mind or muscles is an often hopeless and sometimes misleading task. After all, the brain is part of the body. This was a point emphasized by Michio Ikai and Arthur Steinhaus in 1961 when they studied the psychological effects of surprise gunshots on muscle strength. Psychology, they wrote, is a special case of brain physiology. In other words, feelings and emotions and urges are as physiologically real as changes in core temperature or decreases in hydration, and are mediated by chemical signals. So, when oxygen levels in the brain drop, are we compelled by failing neurons or safety circuitry to slow down, or do we simply decide to slow down? Is there a difference? Whatever the answers, and I don't think we know them at this point, the outcome is clear. We slow down. Chapter 8. Heat. Blame it on the Kentuckiana sun, which was beating down with its customary August fierceness. Or blame the untamable restlessness of boys who have just started a new school year, or the girls' soccer game getting underway on an adjacent field. For whatever reason, the football players on the practice field at Pleasure Ridge Park High School were not listening to their coach, Jason Stinson, as he called for his starters to take their positions for a scrimmage. Eventually, Stinson, who had taken over the head coaching job in the Louisville suburb that year after 3 years as an assistant, ran out of patience. "On the line," he roared. "If we're not going to practice, we're going to run." For the next 30 to 40 minutes, the players ran gassers, an all-too-familiar conditioning drill that involved sprinting back and forth across the field four times. A single gasser takes about a minute. After eight of them, some of the boys had slowed to a walk, enraging Stinson even more. He pulled eight of the worst offenders out of the line and had them start up-downs, a tougher drill that alternated between running on the spot and dropping to the ground while the others continued running gassers. "We're gonna run," he told them, "until somebody quits." During the 12th gasser, a boy named David Englert, who had already quit the team three times, only to return, walked off the field yet again. "Ding, ding, ding," Stinson proclaimed. "We have a winner!" Practice was over, and the players began to disperse. A sophomore named Max Gilpin was walking across the field to collect the equipment he had shed during the gassers when his legs began to wobble. Two of Gilpin's teammates propped him up and hauled him over to a nearby shade tree where he lost consciousness. The teammates called for help. Soon he was surrounded by assistant coaches, then loaded onto a gator driven by the school's athletic director. He was doused in water and cooled with ice packs. Someone called 911, but it was too late. 3 days later, on August 23, 2008, at Kosher Children's Hospital, Max Gilpin died of complications stemming from heat stroke. What's most chilling about Gilpin's death is how unsurprising it is. According to a tally kept by the National Center for Catastrophic Sport Injury Research, a total of 143 football players died from heat stroke between 1960 and 2016. The vast majority of those deaths were high schoolers, and they generally took place during summer practices when the weather was hottest and the players were least fit. But even pros are not immune. The heatstroke death of Minnesota Vikings offensive tackle Corey Stringer during a training camp in 2001 put the issue on front pages around the country. albeit briefly. Gilpin's death was unique in one respect, though. Exactly a week after the fateful practice, Louisville's chief prosecutor announced that he had asked local police to open an investigation into the case, a first in heat-related sports deaths. 5 months later, Jason Stinson was formally charged with reckless homicide, and another charge of wanton endangerment was subsequently tacked on. Gilpin had pushed beyond his physical limits, or rather, prosecutors argued, he had been pushed beyond his limits by Stinson's barbaric practice, which, according to some eyewitness accounts, had involved denying water to the players. Back in 1996, as Tim Noakes prepared for his famous keynote lecture at the American College of Sports Medicine, he had puzzled not over the fact that some people push themselves to death in the heat, but that most people don't. In some ways, Stinson's 13-day trial in 2009 became a tussle over this observation. The prosecution argued that Gilpin's death was a direct and foreseeable consequence of Stinson's actions. The defense countered that it was a tragic and unforeseeable aberration. Nearly 100 players had been subject to Stinson's barbarism that afternoon. Thousands more were doing similar drills across Kentucky, and more than 1 million boys around the country were suiting up for their high school football teams. The jury's task: to determine what, if anything, made Max Gilpin different. In 1798, Sir Benjamin Thompson, a Massachusetts-born polymath who fled to Britain after the American Revolution, invented sous vide cooking and introduced the potato to Bavaria, where he was granted the title Count Rumford, sparked a revolution in the study of heat. The muscular exertions of 2 horses, he showed, could generate enough heat over the course of a few hours to boil 2.25 gallons of water. It would be difficult to describe the surprise and astonishment expressed in the countenances of the bystanders, he reported, on seeing so large a quantity of cold water heated and actually made to boil without any fire. The human body, as Thompson's experiment suggested, is quite literally a furnace. It transforms the energy from food into mechanical work, and this transformation generates heat as a sometimes useful and sometimes inconvenient byproduct. The harder you work, the more heat you generate. The first rigorous investigation of the efficiency of the human engine, which involved months of experiments on a professional cyclist named Melvin A. Mode in a Boston laboratory in 1911 and 1912, recorded typical values of 20 to 25%. For every 100 calories of food you eat, in other words, you might get 25 calories of useful work and 75 calories of heat. As wasteful as that sounds, it's surprisingly similar to the efficiency of a typical internal combustion engine. The heat generated by your car's engine can be pretty useful on a cold day. It's what blasts through your heating vents to warm up the interior. The same is true for human heat production, which is why even extreme cold is rarely a limiting factor for endurance athletes, whose furnaces burn far hotter than most. Under normal circumstances, it's very rare for people to reach the limits of their cold tolerance, if they're appropriately dressed, says Ira Jacobs, a University of Toronto researcher and former chief scientist with Canada's Department of National Defense. For athletes, the biggest cold-related problems arise when your activity level changes, which happens if you get too tired to maintain the effort level that has been keeping you warm. And it's worse if your clothes get wet and lose their insulative powers. That's what happened during a notorious hiking competition on the moors of Yorkshire in 1964, when 3 young men died in above-freezing but rainy conditions. A tragedy investigated by Griffith Pugh, the physiologist who helped guide Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay to the summit of Mount Everest. In the 1990s, Jacobs notes, the same type of hiker's hypothermia led to the deaths of 4 U.S. Rangers during training exercises in Florida, of all places. Once the furnace goes out, even mild cold can kill. Far more common are the thermoregulatory problems that arise in hot weather, because the body is like a car with no air conditioning. You've got no way of actively cooling yourself, so the best you can do is get rid of excess heat as quickly as possible. At rest, about 250 milliliters, half a pint, of blood per minute flows through the vessels near your skin, carrying heat away from your core and releasing it to the environment primarily through radiation in the form of electromagnetic waves and convection as moving air carries it away. As a result, you're always giving off heat at a rate of about 100 watts, just like a light bulb, except mostly at infrared rather than visible wavelengths, which perfectly balances the excess heat produced by the basal metabolic reactions that keep you alive. Once you start pedaling your bike, that changes quickly. Because of the body's imperfect efficiency, cycling at 250 watts generates as much as 1,000 watts of excess heat. Running at 10 miles per hour produces a sizzling 1,500 watts. In response, the blood vessels in your skin dilate dramatically, allowing up to 8 liters of blood per minute, a 30-fold increase, to course through them and dump heat to the air around you. The opposite happens in cold temperatures, leading to what scientists call physiological amputation, as your body conserves heat by cutting off blood supply to extremities. You also begin to sweat. The transformation of liquid water to vapor as sweat evaporates consumes energy, creating a powerful cooling effect on the skin. In very hot conditions, when the air temperature is comparable to or higher than your skin temperature, evaporation is the only effective cooling method you've got. And if it's so humid that sweat starts dripping off you instead of evaporating, the clock is ticking as your core temperature starts to inch upward. At 3:45 p.m. on the day of Max Gilpin's death, Coach Stinson filled out and signed the daily weather records as his players took to the field. He noted a temperature of 94 degrees, with humidity, as measured by the school's hygrometer, of 32%. Plugging those two numbers into a chart produced a heat index of 94, one below the threshold of 95, at which rules about compulsory water breaks and removal of bulky equipment would kick in. It was hot, though not as hot as some of the previous practices that summer. When the heat index had soared to 103 a few weeks earlier, Stinson had run the practice with helmets off. In that respect, Gilpin's death was unusual. It didn't happen on the first day or even the first week of summer practice. It was the team's sixth week, and every single one of their 29 previous workouts had taken place with a heat index above 80, including 5 above 95. When you exercise repeatedly in hot conditions, your body's protective responses get progressively better. You sweat more heavily, starting at a lower temperature. Your vessels dilate even wider to deliver heat-laden blood to the skin, and the total volume of blood in your body increases, allowing your heart rate to stay lower during exercise. This acclimatization process takes about 2 weeks, which is why organizations like the National Athletic Trainers Association recommend limiting intensity and the use of full equipment during the first 14 days of football practice each summer. The idea that we can adapt to hot conditions has been known anecdotally for centuries. In 1789, for example, a British army doctor in India observed that heat-related health problems became less and less common after the first few days of each new military campaign. But it wasn't until the 1930s that the adaptation process was studied systematically. The impetus was a rash of heat stroke deaths, 26 in 1926 alone, in South African gold mines, as ever deeper shafts, more than 1,000 meters below the surface, penetrated into rocks that could be as hot as 140 degrees. A young doctor named Aldo Driosti was assigned by Rand Mines Limited to find a solution to this problem. The African workers in the company's City Deep Mine in Johannesburg, where Driosti was assigned, were already given an acclimatization period of up to 14 days when they first started working underground, during which two workers would share a single shovel so that neither would work non-stop. But it clearly wasn't working, since 20 workers had died of heat stroke at City Deep between 1926 and 1931. And perhaps more important to the mine's owners, letting all workers undergo this acclimatization period, when only a few seemed susceptible to heat stroke, hurt the bottom line. The financial position of the mine, Driosti explained to colleagues at a mining symposium in 1935, was such as to be profoundly affected by this loss of efficiency. The challenge was to figure out which workers were most likely to be vulnerable to heat, and find the quickest way to prepare them for the rigors of underground work. To do this, Driosti converted an unused hospital ward into a heat chamber, crisscrossed with perforated pipes releasing steam, where up to 50 workers at a time could undergo the heat tolerance test he devised. The test involved stripping naked and shoveling piles of rock back and forth with a partner for 1 hour at a temperature of 95 degrees, overseen by a specially trained native boss boy. After testing 20,000 workers in his chamber, Driosti was able to divide his subjects into three groups based on how high and how quickly their body temperature rose, and assigned these groups either 4, 7, or 14-day acclimatization periods. As shocking as some of Driosti's work sounds to modern ears, it was strikingly successful in reducing heatstroke deaths at City Deep, and in getting the miners working at full steam as quickly as possible. In the years that followed, researchers continued to tinker with the ideal acclimatization protocol. Studies during World War II, when Allied troops were preparing for combat in stifling jungle and desert environments, found that 60 to 90 minutes of moderate exercise per day in hot conditions would produce rapid physiological changes within a few days, with full acclimatization taking place within about 2 weeks. Simply living through a hot summer isn't enough. You have to stress your system with exercise. And that, as it turns out, is exactly what Max Gilpin and his teammates had been doing each day at practice for 6 weeks by the time he died. Whatever culpability Stinson had, in other words, it wasn't a result of jumping into full practices too quickly. In the late 1990s, researchers at Denmark's storied August Krogh Institute at the University of Copenhagen carried out a simple experiment to test the effects of core temperature on the limits of endurance. 7 cyclists completed a series of rides to exhaustion in hot and humid conditions, pedaling until they were physically unable to sustain a minimum cadence of 50 strokes per minute at the goal pace. Before each ride, they spent 30 minutes soaking up to the neck in cool, neutral, or warm water, so that their starting core temperatures were roughly 97, 99, or 101 degrees Fahrenheit. As expected, the riders lasted longest when they were pre-cooled, more than doubling their performance compared to the preheated condition. But despite the large differences between trials, the cyclists' core temperatures at exhaustion were strikingly consistent. In nearly every ride by every rider, the thermometer read between 104 and 104.5 degrees at the moment of failure. It was as if, in crossing that critical threshold, a temperature-sensitive circuit breaker had been tripped. Sports scientists were quick to appreciate the potential performance benefits implied by the study. The Australian Olympic team brought ice baths to the sun-drenched 2004 Games in Athens so that athletes could plunge in shortly before their events. In 2008, they adopted a simpler and more practical approach, shipping 7 slushy machines to Beijing and deploying them at the venues for track, cycling, soccer, triathlon, and several other sports. Just as the transformation of liquid water to vapor cools your skin when you sweat, the phase change energy of ice melting to water in your stomach provides an extra cooling boost beyond what you would get from simply drinking a cold drink. Tests by Australian sports scientists showed that a crushed ice slurry sweetened to the same degree as a sports drink could lower core temperatures by 1 degree Fahrenheit, and in consequence, boost endurance in the heat. One curious fact about the slushies was they didn't just lower the athlete's initial temperature. In some cases, they also allowed them to push to a slightly higher core temperature before reaching exhaustion. The difference was minor, about 0.5 degree of Fahrenheit, but intriguing nonetheless. By drinking the slushies, researchers speculated the athletes might have also cooled their brains as the ice passed through their mouth and throat. Earlier studies with dogs and goats, whose brains were cooled by irrigating cold water through their noses, had suggested that brain temperature, rather than core temperature, which is typically measured rectally, is what determines your ultimate thermal limits. If a slushy cools your brain, then your brain lets you keep pedaling a little longer, even as the rest of your body heats up beyond its usual limits. A related possibility is that you have temperature sensors in your stomach itself where the slushy melts. Until recently, such a possibility would have been dismissed as fanciful. But in 2014, Ollie Jay and his colleagues at the University of Ottawa's Thermal Ergonomics Laboratory showed that they could alter sweat rate in cyclists by delivering warmed or cooled fluid directly to their stomachs via a tube inserted through the nose. Jay, who has since moved to the University of Sydney, notes that this may help explain the long-standing tradition in some cultures of drinking a hot drink, like tea, during scorching summer afternoons. By triggering the temperature receptors in your stomach, the hot drink ramps up your sweating response without heating the rest of your body, which has the net effect of cooling you down. So, is it brain temperature or stomach temperature that matters most? It's probably a bit of both, along with temperature signals from other parts of the body like the skin. There's a reason athletes don ice-filled vests and cooling sleeves and drape ice towels over their necks. These interventions don't alter your core temperature, but they do influence how hot you feel, and that in turn dictates how hard you're able to push. Further evidence that perception is reality. A British study in 2012 showed that cyclists in a heat chamber went 4% faster when the thermometer was rigged to display a falsely low temperature, 79 instead of 89 degrees Fahrenheit. This perception-centered view runs counter to the prevailing notion that heat slows you down through its direct physiological effects on your body. But the truth is that few of us ever encounter the critical temperature threshold that makes people keel over in laboratory heat chamber tests. Instead, we instinctively and perhaps unwillingly moderate our pace to stay below that threshold. As South African sports scientist Ross Tucker has shown, when you set out to run a 10K on a hot summer day, your pace is slower right from the start, long before your body has even begun to warm up. Heat doesn't act like a light switch that flicks your muscles off. In most real-world situations, as Tucker explained to me, it's a dimmer switch, controlled by the brain for your own protection. That doesn't mean your body is irrelevant. Max Gilpin had been training hard between his freshman and sophomore years in high school, hitting the weight room with his father 2 or 3 times a week for an hour or more per session. His father told him about his own steroid use as a younger man and warned him about the dangers of these illicit drugs. Instead, he suggested Max take creatine, a legal over-the-counter supplement that helps enhance muscle gains. By the time Max started 10th grade, he had packed on about 27 pounds since the previous year, and at 6'2", he weighed 216 pounds. He wasn't the biggest guy on the football team, but he was a substantial presence. Pretty much the opposite, in fact, of a typical elite marathon runner. In 2013, researchers at France's National Sport Institute collected anthropomorphic data on the top 100 marathoners in the world for each year between 1990 and 2011. They noticed a surprising trend. Marathon runners were shrinking at an alarming rate. In 1990, the average top 100 runner had clocked in at just over 5'8" and 131 pounds. By 2011, those numbers had dropped to under 5'7" and 124 pounds. The reason, the researchers suspected, was simple. The heavier you are, the more heat you generate while running around. Tall people also have more skin surface area, which allows them to shed more heat by sweating. But the extra weight swamps the effects of the extra skin, putting bigger and taller runners at a subtle disadvantage. As marathoning became a big-money sport in the 1990s and 2000s, marathoners' bodies became ever more specialized for staying cool. At the opposite end of the spectrum, football players' bodies are optimized for a more brutal contest. And in particular, linemen like Max Gilpin, giant locomotives of destruction, are the most vulnerable, accounting for 50 of the 58 heatstroke deaths among football players between 1980 and 2009. With each passing sprint, Gilpin's temperature and his perception of that temperature edged upward. After 6 gassers, Stinson began dismissing the fastest runners. After 8, he had the remaining players remove their helmets and keep going. After 10, they pulled off their jerseys and shoulder pads. Gilpin was not a fast runner, so he had no hope of an early reprieve, but he kept pushing himself nonetheless. He was, to borrow a word from his adoring mother, a pleaser, Sports Illustrated's Thomas Lake later reported. His father, who sometimes refused to drive him home after practice if he didn't perform well, was watching from the sidelines. Could Gilpin's eagerness to please have spurred him to push beyond his limits? According to the critical temperature studies, he should have been unable to continue once his core temperature hit 104 degrees. Turns out, though, that critical temperature isn't quite as immovable as the initial studies suggested. Stephen Chung, an avid cyclocross racer and environmental physiologist at Brock University in Canada, first explored this topic during his doctoral studies. In a military-funded experiment, he showed that fit, well-trained athletes could push to a higher core temperature during a treadmill test than less fit subjects. Evidence that the brain's temperature settings can indeed be altered. Chung's most recent work provides even more remarkable evidence of the brain's power. He and his colleagues put a group of 18 trained cyclists through a battery of physical and cognitive tests at 95 degrees Fahrenheit. Then half the cyclists received 2 weeks of training in motivational self-talk, specifically tailored to exercising in heat, which basically involved suppressing negative thoughts like, "It's so hot in here," or "I'm boiling," and replacing them with motivational statements like, "Keep pushing, you're doing well." The self-talk group improved their performance on one of the endurance tests from 8 minutes to 11 minutes, and in doing so, pushed their core temperatures at exhaustion more than half a degree higher. We're now pretty sure it's not just a physical thing, Chung says of the critical temperature concept. There seems to be a strong mental psychological component to it. The right frame of mind, in other words, allows you to push beyond your usual temperature limits. Even if you're already fit, you can still improve your perception of heat and how you perform in it. There's still a mystery, though. Self-talk enabled Chung's cyclists to push their core temperature a mere half degree higher before collapsing from exhaustion. Max Gilpin's temperature eventually reached an organ-melting 109.4 degrees, 5 full degrees above the usual limit. We've traditionally viewed heatstroke as the last stop on a continuum. First you feel warm, then you're uncomfortably hot, then you get heat exhaustion, and finally, if you don't stop, you develop heatstroke. But most people are physically incapable of pushing their temperature to anywhere near 109 degrees. To reach that extreme, something different must be going on. In 2002, a pair of doctors from the sunny climes of Saudi Arabia and Texas published a joint paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, proposing a revised definition of heatstroke. It's not just about body temperature, they argued. Heatstroke involves a systemic inflammatory response that ultimately triggers a cascade of escalating symptoms that lead to multi-organ failure. The body's defenses against heat, as we learned earlier, involve shunting blood toward the skin, where it releases heat. The flip side of this response is that the gut and other internal organs are starved of blood and oxygen. Eventually, this allows toxins that are normally corralled in the gut to begin leaking into the bloodstream, where they trigger a system-wide inflammatory surge. Heatstroke isn't just about getting hot. It's about a surge of inflammation that disables the body's normal temperature defenses. So, why does the inflammatory response spiral out of control in a few people? There's a long list of factors that nudge your heatstroke risk upward, but researchers at the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine, in a 2010 review, singled out three in particular: heavy, poorly ventilated clothing, pre-existing illness, and the use of certain drugs such as amphetamines. Gilpin's football equipment ticked the first box. He likely ticked the second one, too. His stepmother told doctors that he'd had a headache and felt unwell that morning, and several of his friends provided similar testimony. The medical evidence was inconclusive. His blood tests showed signs of viral infection, but couldn't distinguish whether it started before or after he was admitted to hospital. And the toxicology test at the hospital confirmed the third risk factor, too. Gilpin was taking Adderall, an amphetamine-based drug, to treat attention deficit disorder. Perhaps the most famous heatstroke casualty in sports is the British cyclist Tom Simpson, who died less than a mile from the summit of Mount Ventoux on a sizzling day during the 1967 Tour de France. Simpson's will to win and capacity for self-punishment were notorious, and when he began zigzagging back and forth across the road, then tumbled to the ground, his response, according to a stirring but probably apocryphal story, was to cry, "Put me back on my bike." He managed to pedal another quarter mile or so before collapsing again and was dead long before a police helicopter ferried him to a nearby hospital. Like Gilpin, Simpson had been sick in the days prior to his final ride. His mechanic recalled hosing diarrhea off his bike after the stage a few days earlier, thanks to an unpleasant stomach bug whose effects still lingered. But what cycling history remembers about Simpson is the amphetamines. At the time of his collapse, he had 3 pill tubes in his jersey, 2 empty and 1 half full, and the autopsy confirmed their presence in his blood. The standard account of his death is that the pills impaired his judgment, leaving him so doped that he did not know he had reached the limit of his endurance, as Britain's Daily Mail put it a few weeks later. The truth is a little more complicated. In the 1980s, a biochemist and enthusiastic marathon runner at the University of Oxford, Eric Newsholm, proposed that fatigue during endurance exercise might result in part from changes in the concentration of neurotransmitters in the brain. That hypothesis didn't pan out, but it led to a string of studies testing the effects of various brain-altering drugs on endurance. Paxil, Prozac, Celexa, Effexor, Wellbutrin, Ritalin, and others. Under normal conditions, the drugs had minimal effects, but in hot conditions, drugs that increased concentrations of the neurotransmitter dopamine in the brain had a dramatic effect. Even at rest, subjects taking dopamine reuptake inhibitors, which increase the brain's dopamine levels, amphetamines are in this class of drug, had higher core temperatures, suggesting that the drugs altered the perception and internal regulation of heat. Once the subjects started exercising in the heat, they were able to push farther and harder, causing their temperatures to rise beyond their usual critical threshold, even though they didn't feel hotter. Their safety break didn't work, explains Roman Musin, a physiologist at Virgie University, Brussels, in Belgium, who conducted some of the key experiments. They became capable of pushing into the danger zone without negative feedback from their central nervous system. This, he adds, is likely what happened to Tom Simpson. At Jason Stinson's trial, a series of medical experts, including one who had initially been approached by the prosecution, testified that Gilpin's Adderall use had likely contributed to his susceptibility to heat stroke. Of course, millions of people in the United States take Adderall regularly, and this hasn't fueled an epidemic of heat stroke, although one study by University of Georgia researchers estimated that heat-related football deaths tripled between 1994 and 2009, a period during which prescriptions of Adderall and related drugs more than doubled among teens. By any measure, Gilpin's death was a very low-probability event, a lightning strike, with no obvious cause. But the accretion of subtle risk factors, the Adderall, the illness, and perhaps the creatine, which some scientists believe can contribute to heat illness, made Gilpin just a little more of a lightning rod than usual that afternoon. On this list of contributing factors, one item is conspicuously absent. Dehydration. This was the root of the criminal case based on reports that Stinson had denied his players water during the practice, and on the general assumption that most problems in the heat stem from not drinking enough. Under scrutiny, the eyewitness descriptions of the football practice, the most damning of which came from Stinson's brother's ex-girlfriend who was watching the girls' soccer game on an adjacent field, turned out to be misleading. The full team had three scheduled water breaks during the practice, and individual players were drinking between drills. There was, to be sure, plenty of yelling. Even Stinson's attorney told the judge, "I think you can almost take judicial notice that Jason Stinson was being a jerk that day." But the boys drank, and the blood and urine tests performed when Gilpin arrived at the hospital showed that he was not even moderately dehydrated. That fact, more than anything else, is what convinced the jury to acquit Stinson after less than 90 minutes of deliberation. Contrary to the intuition drummed into us by a generation of public health messages, drinking more would not have saved Max Gilpin. And that, it turns out, is not the only piece of conventional wisdom about hydration that is wrong. Chapter 9. Thirst. Pablo Valencia and Jesus Rios left the waterhole a few hours before dawn on August 15, 1905, loading their horses with a week's worth of pinole and 3 gallons of water. They were on their way to stake a claim for a lost mine that Valencia had discovered a few months earlier in the remotest reaches of the Sonoran Desert near the Arizona-Mexico border. But as they rode deeper into the sandy barrens, their mouths parching in the oven-dried air, they realized that they had misjudged their water needs. Valencia told Rios to take the horses and backtrack 35 miles to the waterhole to refill their canteens, and they arranged a rendezvous 24 hours later on the far side of a sierra in the distance. Valencia continued on foot to the claim site, where he collected samples and posted the requisite notices. Rios fetched the water and headed back into the desert. But the rendezvous didn't happen. One or both of them must have gone to the wrong hill, and they each wandered aimlessly until Rios gave up and left his partner for dead. The human body is about 50 to 70% water, and it needs pretty much all of it. You're constantly losing water, not just from sweat, but also from urine, and more subtle leaks, like the moisture in your breath. And under normal circumstances, you're constantly replacing it by eating and drinking. Your fluid balance fluctuates a bit throughout the day, thanks to meal and activity patterns, but from one day to the next, it's regulated with remarkable precision. A 150-pound person typically carries around about 40 liters of water, and that total is fixed to within less than a liter. One exception is the fluctuations that occur throughout a woman's menstrual cycle, which can add and then subtract more than 2 liters of retained water. When you fail to replace lost fluids, you start craving a drink, and your kidneys begin reabsorbing fluid that would otherwise become urine. If that's not enough to restore your internal balance, fluid will start draining out of your cells and into your veins and arteries to maintain the necessary volume of blood pumping through your body. These adjustments will buy you some time, but eventually your blood will get so concentrated that your brain will start shrinking as fluid is sucked out by osmosis, tearing delicate cerebral membranes and ultimately killing you. According to calculations by U.S. Army researchers in a wilderness medicine textbook, you might last, in theory, for about 7 days without water under ideal indoor conditions before reaching this critical point. If you're lost in a hot desert and travel only by night, your expected survival plummets to 23 hours. If you also travel during the day, it's 16 hours. Valencia was a vigorously fit 40-year-old ex-sailor-turned-prospector, deep-chested and strong-limbed. Indeed, a contemporary described him, one of the best-built Mexicans known to me. But the circumstances were stacked against him. Daytime temperatures hovering around 100 degrees, nighttime lows in the 80s, cloudless skies and scant humidity. By the evening of his second day in the desert after failing to find Rios, he was completely out of water and was forced to begin gargling his own urine. Rather than heading straight back to the waterhole, he decided to head north toward an old wagon trail in the hopes of finding help sooner. Along the way, he killed a few spiders and flies, but his mouth was so dry that he struggled to swallow them. On his fourth day in the desert, he caught and ate a scorpion. He was now drinking his urine, which by this time was mucho malo, very bad. He was already beating the odds, since half the victims of desert thirst in the area died within 36 hours, and nearly all within 3 days. But he didn't quit. Fueled by the dream of knifing Rios, who he believed had betrayed him to keep the lost mine for himself, he walked, then staggered, then crawled on. 8 days after Valencia and Rios had set out from the waterhole, a scientist named William J. McGee, who had been camped there for 100 days taking weather measurements, was woken from a deep sleep by an anguished, guttural roar. Rushing a quarter mile down the trail, he found Valencia, stark naked and shrunken to a skeleton. His lips had disappeared as if amputated, leaving low edges of blackened tissue. His teeth and gums projected like those of a skinned animal, but the flesh was as black and dry as a hank of jerky. His nose was withered and shrunken to half its length. His eyes were set in a winkless stare, with surrounding skin so contracted as to expose the conjunctiva, itself as black as the gums. He could barely see or hear, and his tongue had all but disappeared. He had covered between 100 and 150 miles on foot, and had crawled for the last 7 miles across a stony and cactus-dotted plain, leaving him covered in deep cuts and scratches that were too dry to bleed. But he lived. McGee slowly nursed him back to health with judicious amounts of water, coffee, and bird fricassee with rice and shredded bacon, and presented the remarkable case report at a medical conference in 1906. Whether this constitutes a record of some sort is hard to say. Older editions of the Guinness Book of World Records note the case of Andreas Mihavich, an 18-year-old Austrian who was locked up in a small-town jail in 1979 after being a passenger in a minor car accident, and then, the arresting officers later testified, simply forgotten. It wasn't until 18 days later that a horrific stench emanating from the basement reminded them of Mihavich's presence. While he had lost nearly 50 pounds, he too lived. Presumably, medical experts speculated, because the basement cell was so unpleasantly dank that he was able to lick drops of condensation from the walls. At any rate, Valencia clearly stretched the limits of human dehydration well beyond their usual breaking point, and his case offers one additional twist. After a week, with no water, in furnace-like heat, covering more than 100 miles on foot, he was very, very thirsty. But he didn't get heat stroke. No topic of advice in modern sports science has provoked more whiplash than hydration. A century ago, the prevailing advice to endurance athletes was to avoid drinking at all costs. "Don't get in the habit of drinking and eating in a marathon race," warned James E. Sullivan, the author of a 1909 guide to distance running and the namesake of the award given to the nation's top amateur athlete each year. "Some prominent runners do, but it is not beneficial." The logic was that drinking fluids would likely upset your stomach and wouldn't be absorbed into your system until the race was finished anyway. That advice was still state-of-the-art in 1968 when 21-year-old Ambie Burfoot ran the Boston Marathon on a scorching day without drinking anything, losing nearly 10 pounds in the process, and won. But changes were afoot. In 1965, a security guard named Dwayne Douglas at the University of Florida's Health Center was chatting with one of the researchers in the building who specialized in kidney medicine. Douglas, a former Philadelphia Eagles player and a volunteer assistant with the Gators football team, was puzzled by how much weight his players lost, as much as 18 pounds, he reported, and the fact that, as he delicately put it, "My football players do not wee-wee during the game." The specialist, Robert Cade, was intrigued. He got permission to test players during practices and eventually came up with a drink containing water, sugar, and salts to replace what the players were losing in sweat. Then, when the concoction proved to be undrinkable, added some lemon juice at his wife's suggestion. The head coach allowed Cade to try the drink on his freshman team during an intra-squad scrimmage with the B team, and after being pushed around for 2 quarters, the well-hydrated freshman surged to a lead in the second half as the B team wilted. The varsity team used the drink the next day to come back from a 13-0 halftime deficit and eke out a narrow win over heavily favored Louisiana State in 102-degree heat. And the drink that became known as Gatorade never looked back. It's worth noting that Gatorade isn't just a rehydrator. Its sugar also restocks the fuel stores that your muscles are burning through, a topic we'll explore in the next chapter. But the rise of Gatorade kicked off a new era of interest in hydration for athletes, with generously funded research seemingly confirming its importance. A few months before his Boston Marathon win, Burfoot had completed a series of 20-mile treadmill runs at 6-minute-mile pace while drinking water, Gatorade, or nothing. Part of the very first external scientific study funded by Gatorade. Many other studies followed, and in 1988, the company established its own Gatorade Sports Science Institute to help spread the message. By 1996, the Gatorade-sponsored American College of Sports Medicine's official position was that athletes should drink early and often in an attempt to replace all the water lost through sweating or consume the maximal amount that can be tolerated. And it wasn't just athletes. Pervasive dehydration was increasingly cast as the hidden scourge of a generation, insidiously robbing children of their vitality and office workers of their cognitive edge. Then came hyponatremia, the death of 28-year-old Cynthia Lucero, who collapsed 4 miles from the finish line of the 2002 Boston Marathon, focused worldwide attention on a problem that had first been identified more than 2 decades earlier. Though Lucero complained of feeling dehydrated and rubber-legged before she collapsed, hospital tests revealed the opposite problem. Following the prevailing advice to athletes, she had drunk as much as she could stomach during her run, causing the level of sodium in her blood to become diluted. That's what hyponatremia, sometimes referred to as water intoxication, means. Her lungs filled with fluid, and her brain began to swell, which, after a few hours, led to her death. Subsequent studies revealed that the condition, though not usually fatal, was showing up in a handful of runners at nearly every major marathon. In 2003, USA Track and Field rewrote their guidelines to suggest that runners should drink when they're thirsty rather than striving to replace all sweat losses or consuming the maximal amount that can be tolerated. Other organizations followed, and researchers began to look more closely at the deeply entrenched tenets of conventional wisdom about hydration, with surprising and still controversial results. Well, you've heard the warnings. Drink now because losing just 2% of your weight will hurt your performance, and by the time you feel thirsty, it's already too late. This concept of voluntary dehydration, in which thirst is an inadequate barometer of your fluid needs, dates back to a series of wartime studies led by University of Rochester researcher Edward F. Adolph, which he summarized in a classic 1948 book called Physiology of Man in the Desert. With the outbreak of desert warfare in North Africa in 1941, Adolph and his colleagues were dispatched to the Sonoran Desert in California to investigate soldiers' water needs. At the time, there was a widespread belief that you could train yourself to drink less water, which in turn would minimize wasteful sweat losses. Adolph and his colleagues debunked this notion and demonstrated that staying hydrated was important even for well-acclimatized desert veterans. But they also made a curious observation. In long desert marches of up to 8 hours, even when the men were allowed to drink as much as they pleased, they finished the marches in a state of dehydration, having lost 2 or 3 or sometimes even 4% of their starting weight. Tank crews lost an average of 3% of their body weight after a few hours of simulated battle. The 8 crewmen of a B-17 Flying Fortress returned from a 2-hour low-altitude mission having lost 1.6%. The logical conclusion, then, was that you need to drink more than you really want to in order to avoid getting dehydrated. Why should you go to the trouble of drinking more than you want? Adolph's studies suggested that the consequences of dehydration included generalized discomfort, fatigue, apathy, low morale, and unwillingness, and inability to undertake strenuous activity. Then, beginning in the late 1960s, studies, including the one that Amby Burfoot participated in, began to link dehydration more specifically with overheating. It made sense, since dehydration reduces the volume of blood available to shunt heat to your skin and in extreme cases might even compromise your ability to sweat. The differences in core temperature observed in these studies were subtle, measured in fractions of a degree. Still, hydration, drink as much as you can tolerate, became the go-to advice for preventing heat stroke. It wasn't just a question of avoiding catastrophes, though. Researchers began to publish findings suggesting that even relatively mild dehydration would hinder both physical and mental performance. A U.S. Army study in 1966 had soldiers walk to exhaustion on an uphill treadmill in a hot room while normally hydrated, dehydrated by 2% or dehydrated by 4%. Sure enough, their walking time dropped by an average of 22% and 48% respectively in the two dehydrated trials. Subsequent studies produced similar results, entrenching the familiar 2% rule. Put all these findings together, voluntary dehydration, overheating, declining physical performance, and you have a compelling case that even mild dehydration can be debilitating, if not dangerous. But that's not the only explanation that fits the observed facts. Some of the most vivid cautionary tales about dehydration focus on Alberto Salazar, the irascible 1980s marathon star who now coaches an exclusive and, due to recent accusations of unethical supplement and prescription medicine use, controversial squad of some of the world's best runners at Nike headquarters in Oregon. Salazar was famous for his unyielding racing style and his appetite for suffering. As a 19-year-old in 1978, he returned home to the Boston suburb of Wayland, Massachusetts, for the summer after a disappointing sixth-place finish at the NCAA Championships had ended his sophomore track season at the University of Oregon. He made a sign to post on his bedroom wall, scrawled in felt-tip pen on a giant piece of poster board that he stared at daily. "You will never be broken again." At the end of that summer, Salazar put this credo into practice at the 7-mile Falmouth Road Race on Cape Cod, where he lined up against some of the best runners in the world, Bill Rogers, Craig Virgin, Rudy Chapa. At the 4-mile mark, he tried to take the lead. "That's the last thing I remember about the race," Salazar later recalled in his memoir, 14 Minutes. Witnesses said he stopped, turned around in a circle, then kept running to the finish where he finished 10th. His next memory is of hearing a series of numbers, 104, 106, 107, "It's not going down, I think we're going to lose him." It was his body temperature. He was submerged in a tub of ice water in the medical tent, suffering from heat stroke, and his life hung in the balance. He was soon rushed to the hospital, where a priest read him his last rites. After an hour, his temperature dropped, and he made a full recovery, and, if anything, he gained confidence from this seeming confirmation of his toughness. 4 years later, Salazar was the world's preeminent distance runner. He had won the New York Marathon in 1980 while still a student at Oregon, and returned the following year to set a world record of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 13 seconds, though the record was subsequently disallowed due to a course measurement issue. His most famous race, though, remains the 1982 Boston Marathon, a head-to-head battle with upstart rival Dick Beardsley, remembered by running fans as the duel in the sun. Boston's noon start meant that the runners faced temperatures in the mid-60s under a cloudless sky, and Salazar drank nearly nothing, perhaps 2 cups of water in total, just as he had done in his New York triumphs. The two men raced stride for stride for nearly the entire distance, with Salazar edging ahead in the final mile, and Beardsley's late comeback attempt reportedly foiled by the motorcycles and media bus clogging up the finishing straight. Salazar once again had to be carted to the medical tent immediately after the finish, where 6 liters of fluid were pumped intravenously into his twitching body. Salazar's famous collapses and abstemious hydration habits are still widely cited as evidence of the link between dehydration and heat stroke. But the picture isn't as simple as it seems. In Falmouth, where he undoubtedly ran himself into heatstroke, the race was only 7 miles long, barely more than half an hour, and he was already in trouble shortly after the halfway mark. Salazar was a prodigious sweater. Later lab tests showed he could squeeze out an